Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. Join us every Saturday for a deep discussion about the biggest stories of the week. Go behind the scenes with journalists, political figures, and newsmakers to get a unique look at our city. And also, I want to hear from you, the listener. So please send any questions, critiques, or sponsorship inquiries to my email at hsanders@wweek.com. Thank you so much and enjoy this episode of the Dive Podcast. Welcome back to the Dive Podcast. I'm your host, Hank Sanders. It's great to have you in today for January 8th, episode 54. We're kicking off season two with a bang. We are joined today by Nigel Jaquis. Yeah, he's a reporter. Yeah, he's got a Pulitzer. No big deal. We're not talking about that, though. We're not looking backwards. We're looking forwards. Nigel brings us the lowdown on two of the biggest names in this year's upcoming gubernatorial election, trying to get the highest seat in the land for Oregon. So who's going to win the Oregon governor race? We've got some big news coming out in that field this week. I'm sure you saw. We'll delve into that. But before we get into those stories, we have to bring you all the headlines, everything that happened this week. This is the 9-Second News Flash. Due to the nature of this episode, we will be talking about the biggest story of the week later on. And that story is, of course, the fact that Nick Kristof was labeled ineligible to run for governor in 2022. More on that story will get you all the details you need to know. So let's just skip past that story and move on to the other stories in the meantime. House Speaker Tina Kotek will be stepping down from her post as Speaker of the House effective January 21st. This was expected as she has decided to devote all of her time now to running for governor. The COVID numbers are piling up on a daily basis. A record 6,200 cases were recorded on January 5th in Oregon, and that breaks the state's single-day record for the most cases. Remember, COVID cases, we want to keep them low, but Omicron, I guess people are saying it's less dangerous than Delta, but still, these numbers are just not great to be seeing as a state. Oregon prisons have reported a dozen deaths in 2 months. But reportedly, none of the deaths are from COVID. 7 of the 12 deaths were from inmates in hospice care already. Interstate 84 is closed again due to landslides, but there's good news elsewhere if you're a big hiker, a big outdoors guy like me. There is good news as Arch Cape Trail is now open following months of repairs on the 1.5-mile stretch of hiking paths. For food, guys, I tried Jerry's Pizza. If you don't know what it is, first off, where have you been? It's all the rage these days. It's a pizza place. They do square-cut, Chicago-style tavern pizza. We interviewed Jerry a few weeks back. Listen to the episode. It's a good interview. And it's just damn good pizza. I think Baby Doll Pizza and Jerry's Pizza might be my two favorite places. Life of Pi is also up there. Let me know if you disagree. Let me know if you have other pizza places you frequent and you like. And if you're looking for a drink, check out Sunflower Sake or Pink Rabbit. And even if you're a Blazers fan, always make sure to drink responsibly. You know how we do. We like to stay safe here. And that's that, folks. This has been the 9-Second News Flash. We turn now to our interview with Nigel Jaquis. This Willamette Week reporter brings us the details on his interview with the candidate for governor, Senator Betsy Johnson. She's currently running as an independent. He also tells us why Nick Kristof was labeled ineligible to run, according to the Secretary of State's office. Here's our interview. Let's go. Okay, Nigel, thanks so much for joining us. And let's just start with Betsy Johnson. I want to get your take on her decision to run as an independent, because the more that I think about it, the more I'm wondering, is running as an independent in Oregon kind of like an underused cheat code? Because you get to skip to the primary, you get to save your war chest for the ninth inning, and you avoid, if you're running as a Democrat, you avoid being labeled as a Kate Brown or a socialist type. And if you're running on the red side, then you avoid being labeled as a Trumpist. Do you think she's got some here?
Well, I think, you know, what we've seen with the current governor is that she has the lowest approval ratings in the country. And what we've seen is that Republicans just cannot win statewide in Oregon with, you know, the one exception of Dennis Richardson running the Secretary of State's race. So I think it is a really interesting concept because, as you point out, she'll get to save all her money for November. She doesn't have to go through a bruising primary where she and an opponent expose each other's negatives. And I do think that we're at a probably a low ebb of confidence in either party from Oregon voters. So I think it's a good time to try. I still think she's going to have to thread a very small needle, because the greatest predictor of electoral performance is that people vote for the parties with which they're registered in. So, you know, what is her natural constituency? It's pretty small. And I think her path to success relies on her getting perhaps the most liberal Democrat and the most conservative Republican. And there's no guarantee that that'll happen.
You asked her, when did Oregon lose its way? And I was surprised by her answer here, because a lot of the things that she blamed the dysfunction for was she blamed it on the partisanship in Oregon. And she said that she thought that Oregon lost their way really during COVID. But partisanship in Oregon has happened way before COVID. I mean, we're a very blue state. We've been run by Democrats for many decades. Were you at all surprised as COVID being the start date for when she saw Oregon going off the rails?
I actually think I thought about that a lot, because initially I was surprised. And then as I thought about it, and as I read the story later in print, I thought, you know, that's kind of right, because prior to COVID, state had really low unemployment. People were unhappy. Yes, there were partisan divisions for sure. But what I think has really accentuated people's unhappiness is things that are national, like having to stay home or having your kids not be able to go to school. But I think what has really focused people on the negative aspects of COVID is sort of the visible aspects of it. And those may be homeless camps in Portland. They may be homeless camps in Medford or in Grants Pass or in Eugene. I think the visual evidence of suffering and of our inability to address large societal problems has become much more evident during COVID. And, you know, we've seen a large increase in violent crime during COVID. We've seen a large increase in vehicular deaths. So were they caused by COVID? Not exactly. But I think that all the things that people were unhappy about or maybe disagreed upon have really been crystallized in the past couple of years in a way they hadn't been before.
Since she says that this is the time when Oregon lost its way, what would Senator Johnson have done differently to handle COVID if she were governor?
Well, I think that, of course, it's easy to be an armchair quarterback or a Monday morning quarterback. I think that she believes that there has been, and I hesitate to speak for her, but I'll try and channel what she told us. I think that she believes there's been a lack of clarity in the governor and the Oregon Health Authority's communication to Oregonians about what they should do and why they should do it and what they should expect to happen. So I think that's been a criticism that a number of people have made of the state, is that, yes, our results have been far better than almost any other state in terms of hospitalization and in terms of deaths, two of the really key indicators of how a state reacts to COVID. But that the messaging has been really inconsistent and really perplexing often to Oregonians.
You've been in a lot of meetings with a lot of politicians, talking your ear off, giving you long-winded answers, talking politics. She seemed different. She seemed like she was giving you very frank. She didn't pull any punches. Was that surprising to you? I know you've probably talked to her in the past, but was her candor surprising as somebody who's been a politician for a long time?
It is not surprising, because I have been around her in the past for, you know, 20 years since she's been in the legislature. But it is refreshing. It is unusual. I can't overstate how unusual it is for a politician, particularly one at a high level, to speak as in such an unguarded fashion. She is different from most other politicians. I suspect that when voters get a chance to listen to her and see her, they will be surprised at how different she is from most politicians.
All right, let's move now over to the Kristoff talk. What did the Secretary of State's office say? Why did they rule him ineligible to run?
Sure. So on January 7th, compliance officials told Nicholas Kristof, the former New York Times journalist who's running as Democratic candidate for governor, that he didn't meet the state's three-year residency requirement. They primarily used as evidence that he had voted in New York in November 2020 as the basis for their determination. There were other factors as well, but that was the big issue. So the Oregon Constitution, which was written 170, 160 years ago, says that in order to run for governor, that one must have been resident in the state 3 years before the election. And that would have required Kristoff to have been resident in Oregon in 2019 because the election's in 2022. He voted in New York in 2020. And when he did so, he said that he wasn't qualified to vote anywhere else. They've taken that to mean that he was a New York resident. And if in legal terms, people say that you can only be resident of one state at a time. So if he was a resident in New York, by definition, he couldn't have been a resident in Oregon. Therefore, he doesn't qualify. So they told him his name would not be on the ballot. And of course, Kristoff reacted very negatively to that. I think he expected that perhaps, but said that he will fight. And in fact, I know that within the next couple of hours, he's going to file a writ of mandamus with the Oregon Supreme Court, meaning that he's going to, his lawyers will go directly to the Supreme Court and make their case that he should be on the ballot.
Like you said, Kristoff is going to appeal this case. And he made a statement, he made a video statement that he posted on Twitter. He went on Twitter and basically blamed the whole ruling on Democratic insiders trying to silence an outsider from running, keeping him from running. He posted all of his thoughts there. You can go into the Twitter section and people don't respond super well to his responses so far. I mean, there's a lot of memes, a lot of funny things, making fun of him, roasting him. It didn't seem to play very well to a lot of Oregonians. Of course, this is just Twitter, but it seemed like people thought that he was coming from a place of privilege and he just thought he could just jump the line and run. How did you read his response? What did you think?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that Twitter is really not representative of anything except a very small slice of often very engaged, often activists or political people, journalists. So I don't put a lot of weight in what Twitter's response to Kristoff was. I think he's raised $2.5 million. I think he's probably even surprised himself with how successful his campaign has been so far. And so, of course, he's angry. I think his reaction is intended to sway the court of public opinion, which is not as important as the Supreme Court, but will potentially influence the Supreme Court. So, I think the Democrats have put themselves in a very interesting position here. They're all about access to democracy. So if the party that's all about access to democracy is throwing a guy off a ballot, that's not a good look. And I think he wants to appeal to a broader audience than the audience that is on Twitter and say, hey, it's not fair. Let's have a debate. Let's have as many people in this primary as possible. And, you know, I'm somewhat sympathetic to that. I'm also sympathetic to the idea that the rules are the rules. So I don't know. I don't know how this will play out.
Nigel, thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, Hank. Thank you.
Bye.
Always trying to keep my balance, but my surface gets slimmer. What used to be a bridge is now the width of a razor. The ones who care about me watch my face get thinner. Their eyes get more concerned while mine get dimmer. Started out having fun, just another way to play. Now I'm falling headfirst into unforgiving ways.
Well, folks, that's our show. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Dive Podcast. See how easy that was? I mean, no one likes reading. No one's got the time for that. You probably listened to this podcast. Maybe you did something else. You multitasked a little bit, did some chores, went driving, whatever it might be you like doing. You can do anything you want while also listening to the show. So we appreciate you spending the time with us. And till next week, we'll see you Saturday. Stay safe, have fun, keep reading. We've got a lot of great content coming at you from Willamette Week. Till then, for Willamette Week, I'm Hank Sanders. See ya. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week. For more information on this podcast or the biggest stories in Portland, go to wweek.com and follow Willamette Week on all socials. We're doing some really cool things related to the podcast on our Instagram and Twitter. It includes giveaways, behind the scenes, etc. A lot of cool things coming your way, so give those a follow. Special thanks to our guests for joining us, and thank you to Aaron Mesh, Mark Zussman, and Brian Panganibon, as well as the entire Willamette Week family. Last but not least, thank you so much to Heather Witte and AmpMusic.co for the music that you hear on this podcast. For Willamette Week, I'm Hank Sanders. This has been the Dive Podcast.